Join us as we gather around the hedge, where we dig into technology, business, and culture with the finest minds in computer networking.
Well, hello, Tom.
Hello, Russ.
I see no dinosaurs, although the plant seems to be doing okay.
Yeah, yeah, the plant's healthy, despite the abuse that it received from you last time.
Oh, boy. I visited Tom at his house a couple of weeks ago. My wife and I ran by and sat down and had a really delicious dinner and just hung out and talked about his plant mostly. That was the topic of conversation for the whole hour and a half, 2 hours was his plant. Yeah.
Well, and you also telling me I had too many monitors, which shocked me that you would tell me I had too many monitors. But
out of purely academic interest, how many is too many?
Five, apparently.
Yeah, five's excessive. You have a problem.
Oh, no.
And that other voice you hear is George Michelson, all the way from Brisbane. And I do believe I see the water. Is that water or is that drying swim trunks on the side there?
We have managed to get the water down using concrete pumps running in reverse. The basement's dry. The lift wells are not. You don't want to look at what's floating in the water after the lid came off the grease trap. And I will be going to the basement in the next 48 hours to see if I can rescue a Teletype ASR33, a Spark 10 desktop, and a Lear Ziegler ADM5 that I had in the stack. But I think they may have gone to the great transistor boneyard in the sky.
Wow. Yep. Were you running them? Was that your primary desktop machine, the Spark? In which case, you only have one monitor, by the way. So,
one monitor with a flyback delay. The Teletype, it used to power on, but it was not RS-232. It was that other 433, I don't know. The loop, current loop. And I couldn't get anything to interface to it. The Lear Ziegler ADM5, yeah, I used that. It was really sweet. But man, the bell tone on that is so harsh. It just blew my ears off. And there's a lot of flyback whine on the scope. So I stopped using that. The Spark, well, the PROM chip died. And those machines, if you don't have the PROM backup, it resets to an all zeros MAC address. And you have to do hex bootstrap to give it a MAC address so that it will DHCP boot so that you can get an OS back on it. So no, Russ, they are not my daily driver.
You know, the flyback noise on that is probably on the Aquadag.
Could I ship it to you to fix?
Well, you could try it.
I like the Lear Ziegler best of all of them simply because of the styling. It's like a VW. It's just absolutely fantastic curved shapes. I mean, the Teletype's a classic. Absolute beautiful design. But the thing is, plastic ages out. And so it got really, really brittle. And a lot of the casing has now broken. It just reached that point where it was deplasticizing. The mechanics are fine. I offered it to a guy in England. He said he spoke with his partner and she told him he was only allowed one Teletype in the house. So, you know, it's kind of, I think they're going for parts.
Oh, that's pretty sad. That's pretty sad. And speaking of ancient technologies, I had an ISDN link when I first started working for Cisco in 96 to the house. And in fact, there was no high-speed internet into my neighborhood. So they had to wire the ISDN link into the corner, into the lock corner so that they could drag the wires to my house. And so I have fond memories of ISDN. And here you are telling us that the days of ISDN are over. Well, I'm sticking.
Yeah, it lasted so long and it did so much. I mean, as I say in the piece I wrote, 25 million customers. My God, that's huge. 25 million? I don't think anyone would consider that a successful Kickstarter kickoff if they did that now. But yeah, it had a good long life, but all technologies reach the end of the road. And in Australia, the ISDN infrastructure, the investment in capacity inside exchanges, the investment in technology to keep this stuff going, it just reached end of life. the telcos looked at their customer base and what they were running, and it was not economically feasible to keep this service operating. There just weren't enough people who needed it to justify the central cost of management. So yeah, it's turn it off time.
Wow. I mean, I guess I have two reactions. The first is, what took you so long?
We're cheapskates.
And the second is, what do you attribute it to? What is causing the cost? Because it's just copper wire and then DSLAMs, right? And so the DSLAMs, I mean, what piece of this is causing the problems that is...
Well, let's roll back the clock a bit, right? Okay. So first of all, it's just copper wire. So that copper wire it's old. It is exceptionally old, and it was bought on classic US Army purchasing methods. This is the spec you must meet. Do not exceed this spec. And so a lot of the in-the-ground investment in copper was bought to a highly specific purchase design, and it had life. And we have quite tough physical conditions. I mean, floods aside, we're not an ideal place for running this stuff. We have high humidity, and we have a lot of temperature variation, and we have savage parrots that seem to love the insulation on aerial wires. So running and managing copper infrastructure comes with burdens of its own. It has a real cost. I mean, it's a massive asset. It was put in the ground on 50, 60 year funding models as shared public utility, and they absolutely got that life out of it. But all these things reach end of life. So if you go to the exchange, you say, oh, it's just the DSLAM. Well, ISDN deployment is kind of one of those weird crossing points, because the head end for ISDN for a lot of economies was actually fully integrated into the exchange. The AXE, the digital exchange that was deployed ubiquitously English
economies.
Like the
SR100, right, those types of things.
These things were classic 19-inch rack width units, but they're behemoths. And so a line card to do a split out of two 64K channels plus one control channel, what we call 2B plus D, that line card is like a cigarette pack slot in a rack. And you get 32 of them in a rack, that's one E1 delivery. I guess for you guys, it would be 24, because you do some weird arithmetic over there. 24 bits? Who counts in 24s? Well, it seems like America does. So those investments, they absolutely were end of life. And what is also running alongside this is the underlying technology to send the signal that ISDN was using is the other kind of signaling. There's this line in the sand. You can have a lot of smart technology, and you can do complex encoding down these wires as if they're a waveguide and get much, much, much higher throughput. But if you do that, nobody else can use the older traditional methods of signaling that consume more bandwidth to get one bit through reliably. Remember, the ground birth of ISDN is the 60s. Transistors are expensive. A transistor radio has like two of them in it, and they're trying really hard to limit the amount of cost for the physical deployment they have to put out there. So the guys who are designing this technology, there's this story, it's in Wikipedia, it's fantastic. The AT&T engineers in Chicago basically used empirical design. They had pits in the ground a certain distance apart, and they played with signaling technology until they could reliably get between 1 and 2 megabits down that length. That became the definition of the signaling spec, because it was the right distance to go between the pits in the physical deployment. So all of that technological burden from the 60s and the 70s in the underlying part, HDLC. Did you do HDLC, Russ?
Yes.
Did you do DDCMP?
Yes,
I did. I was reading about that again. Robbed bit.
Yes.
I mean, here's the thing. The Europeans say, I know, let's take 2 megabits of data and let's divide it into 32 channels. And then let's use one of these channels to do signaling to say what the other 31 are doing. And the Americans say, nah, mate, it's 24 and we're going to steal one bit every now and then off every one of you and make your voice slightly more crappy so that we can have one bit for free from every one of your channels, and we'll use that for signaling. Where was that coming from? So that burden implies technology burdens. And you're right about what took you so long. Well, the thing is, these guys are accountants, and if the tax office told them to write down the capital expenditure on a 25-year life, they were doing 25. They did not want to replace this gear. And the gear stayed in place, and the lines stayed in service until the customer said, what? I'm paying you how much for a 64K line to feed an ATM? I'm sorry, I'm swapping out and putting a mobile phone behind that now. So all the edge devices rolled through a replacement, and people shifted their technology basis away from this technology. I really think the killer was probably VoIP. I think the point when VoIP was able to say, we'll do multi-line delivery to a PBX, ISDN should have been shot at dawn, but instead it's been bleeding out.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That was a long time ago. I mean, VoIP was a long time ago. Has it been bleeding for 15, 20, what is it, 25 years now in VoIP?
Oh, yeah. I've got a Cisco ATX, you know, one of those tiny cigarette boxes that reconverts it back to analog. And I periodically pick up the phone and do my tone dial just to check it's still there. What does it plug into? It plugs into fiber. Excuse me, how do you whistle down a fiber? I have no idea.
Yeah, and so it's interesting because I guess, you know, when I was back as a young pup, ISDN was the big thing, was the big up-and-coming thing, right? And it was a big deal that when you got ISDN, course, I was replacing, shouldn't say this. I was replacing Stroger switches with Martell SL100. Yes. And we used to troubleshoot them with contact fluid. Somebody would call it and say, my line's not working correctly. So you'd go find the circuit they had made and you would spray all the Stroger switches down with contact fluid.
WD-40. No.
That doesn't work as well.
Tom, are you even in this? I mean, is this kind of ancient history archaeology for you?
I was just going to say, Russ keeps giving me crap about dinosaurs, but I don't need them in my office. I got them on the call, two of them right here.
Yeah. So I have this moment that actually is kind of weird. The head-end equipment that you got typically as a customer with things like ISDN was this plug called the V35, right? And it's a head shell with this size with 35 pins in it, or however many it is, 60 in some cases, I think.
Well, on the Cisco AGS and MGS and CGS, it was a 60-pin.
So it was a well-designed plug. It had solid screws. It was big gold connectors. This thing was mechanically never going to fail. And I'm sitting looking at it, looking at what the service delivery on. It's two twisted pairs. 35 pins, two twisted pairs. And so the box in between, it terminates, for want of a better word, pretty much all of those signals. Their control information for the local station to do something to then jam bits down two wires so at the other end it can be reassembled into another 60-pin plug. And I remember looking at it thinking, so is this box a modem? And it used to really freak out the engineers. I'd say, so where's the, you know, ISDN modem? And they'd say, it's not a modem. V35 termination unit made us, not a modem.
Yeah, VTU. That's right.
I'm looking at it thinking, mate, you're kidding yourself. It's a huge honking great modem.
And so what's interesting, well, there's a couple of interesting things that come out of this. The first is that people don't realize that copper deteriorates because they're used to copper in walls. But the reality is, like when I was in the Air Force, one of the things we were doing was we were replacing an old Stroger-based mainframe with about 10,000 lines on it with an SL1000 or SL100. In order to do that, we had to repull all the wires on the entire base because all those wires were 9 to 40 years old at that point.
The resistance in them goes up. If the moisture level in the ground goes up, you start losing circuits.
Yeah, even on poles. These were paper-wrapped, lead-wrapped, copper wiring, and the paper would get soaked and it would soak and, you know, the lead would start breaking down and your resistance levels would go up and you would just see crap on the line. There was nothing you could do. We would just switch people from one pair on the same cable to another pair until we found them a good pair.
Yeah.
And eventually you just run out of pairs and you end up routing people. Oh, there's a line between this building and that building. We'll run them on that. And then we'll run them on a cross connect running 66 blocks with clips across to this other cable to get them back to the mainframe, or over here to this building distribution frame, which was a crossbar switch sitting in some outlying building that would then switch them over to the main Stroger frame. And it was like, it was a mess.
Oh yeah.
So how long did it take? How many years was it before you started getting into these shenanigans you just described? Was it 30 years? And then at 50, it's pretty much dead? Or what was the actual life cycle of copper?
It's a lot more than 50. Some of the copper really dates back to before the Second World War.
Wow.
And that stuff it doesn't have plastic insulation. It's wax and paper, much as Russ is describing. And there are systems where they would they'd embed the whole of the terminal in wax to try and stop water incursion into this thing. So if you had to do any engineering on it, you actually had to soften the wax to free up the circuit endpoints to play with them. No, it's a hell of a lot more than 50. I'd say we probably got 70 years plus in a significant amount of this deployment. But as I said about challenging environments, Australia went classic army cheap. We bought a cable spec that wasn't up to par, and it had some weird new super duper gel technology insulation inside it, which was hydrophilic. It likes moisture. It sucks it up out of the ground, then it starts oozing out the end of the cables. I mean, it's a disaster.
So is that mostly what's installed in Australia? Is it?
Not mostly, but a lot of it. We have a quite interesting customer access network. So the pillars are exposed. We've got two kinds. We've got a round kind, like a sawn off tree trunk, that is, I think, a 50 pair terminating and then another 50 pair going out, and you can cross connect in that. And we've got a small box that's about 2 feet wide and 4 feet high, square, which can take 250 or a couple of hundred pairs and do the same thing. Neither of those were active. The square one might have been, but we were trying to keep runs below 10 to 15 kilometers. And that kind of, if you get to ADSL, the article that I wrote, it talks a bit about the competing technologies. Cheap is shout loudly in fixed frequencies and you'll get through. That's ISDN. Expensive is have lots and lots of circuitry and use this thing as multiple RF channels, which is DSL. It's effectively high frequency signaling down the same thing. It hates old copper. It hates the thing called loading coils. Do you remember them, Russ?
Oh, yeah. We had loading coils on every BDF, every building distribution frame.
Yeah.
Or every building entry point. Was it called a bed or a pet?
So you know, there was a black economy, if I can use that phrase, of giving telco engineers crates of beer to get them to find lines with no loading coils so that you could get a clearer signal. So ADSL, it's a similar heuristic engineering pragmatic outcome. How far can you drive this signal? Well, it's a classic exponential drop-off curve. If you're close to the exchange, you're getting 20 megabits low error rate. You're at the end of 15 kilometers, you're getting 1.5. And your error rate, your bit error rate, is phenomenal. ISDN, it wasn't variable like that. They either delivered you service or they didn't. And to get 2 megabits to your door, if they had to go down every intermediate pit in this system and put an active regenerator in, they would, because that was the nature for us of the universal service obligation. So the cost of the technology is not the imaginary 10 kilometers of copper that you can drive ADSL at 1 megabit. It's the cost of delivering absolute 2-spec telco certified, no errors service. And if need be, spending tens of thousands of dollars to do it to equalize the social outcome.
Yeah, and this is something, these are things people don't realize about copper. One is that it degrades over time. Even the best copper degrades over time. It just does. It's just a thing. In the Air Force, we used to encapsulate copper. We would put copper inside conduit, and then we would pressurize the conduit with nitrogen.
I've seen the head end of that in a main data frame at the university. Beautiful little taps with buckets underneath to let the water out of the pressurized duct.
That's right. That's exactly right. And we used to do the same thing for waveguides. We would have we would be driving 250,000 watts at 1.2 gig up a 90-foot tower. And there's no way you can do that on copper. You just can't. So what you do instead is you put in a waveguide and you pressurize the waveguide with nitrogen. So all those types of transmission systems. The other thing is that a lot of people don't realize about copper is that it does have very, very limited reach. A lot of times when people put fiber to a neighborhood, they're only putting it to the neighborhood. And people say, well, that doesn't do me any good. Well, it actually does because it's reducing the length of the copper run.
We've got a quite complex high-speed network deployment here, and it was originally spec'd to be FTTP, fiber to the premise, and in a political move, it was called multi-technology mix. I have fiber to the premises. People two streets away have fiber to a riser in the ground and then copper for the final mile delivery. Some people have copper all the way. And we've actually had this weird thing. You know the classic diagram of the rate of technology uptake and how washing machines, it was 50 years, and color TVs, it was 15 years, and telephones, blah, and mobile phones, 5 years. ADSL has an interesting shape in that because ADSL, which replaced ISDN in the customer space, Russ, you probably were one of a small number of people domestically who had ISDN delivery. It really wasn't aimed at individuals, was it? It was aimed at businesses.
Businesses.
Yeah, but ADSL went gangbusters. It went everywhere. But the thing is, it maxes out at about 20, 25 meg. VDSL, doing line sensing, and in particular the BMUX, if the BMUX owns every single piece of wire going out, it can do cross-device and cross-customer signaling fixes, and you can get up to 100 to 200 megabits out of these babies. So there's a whole weird thing happening that we went through this period where we had guaranteed service delivery of 64K high speed. We then went to megabit speeds variable, and now we've had to replace that technology well inside the lifetime to get higher speeds out of it because we're not prepared to lay glass to the door.
Yeah,
it's very strange.
It is.
I liked a quality of ISDN people don't talk about so much, which is the integration with the phone system. I mean, we're all here using digital, and none of us particularly care these days about voice. But the plan, the numbering plan, the ubiquitous international subscriber dialing plan, and the fact that ISDN was capable of doing, I can make a call connect on this service to somewhere far, far away and far, far off here that you've never seen. I think that was really very interesting. But the telcos didn't kind of want us to use it. And here in Australia, maybe it was different in America, but here you paid a real premium to get new digital voice. You didn't get untimed local calls. If you wanted the ability to strap two lines together and use it for video conferencing, you paid a premium. And it's kind of weird that they did that in a time when other technology was coming along that was 3 or 4 or 5 or 10 times faster, no premium to use.
Yeah. So, I mean, talk about aging copper. You know, there are situations like you talk about your environment. I know in Greenland, we were driving down the road one day and there was a road crew out working and they had blasting signs up. And I was like, they're blasting on the side of the road. And the guy I was with is like, yeah. That's what they do around here because there's no dirt. It's all rock. So if you want to bury cable, you have to literally blast a trench next to the road. And the problem is that trench collects water and runs copper out. I mean, you just can't keep it out of the water. And so it just, you know, that's the way things work.
So my ISDN and X25 experience capped out at the E series in E1 lines. But I remember hearing people running the national networks and particularly international networks talking about E3 and T3, mm-hmm. which is the superset bundling. And I think a lot of people who think about long haul telecommunications in our space think in terms of the T3 line. Oh, what are you doing? I'm hooking up another T3 to May East, you know, those kinds of things. Nobody was, consciously thinking, oh yeah, that exists because it's a superset bundle of the T1 series.
Or the E1 series, yeah.
You know, ganging them up to make fatter links. And again, the same question comes into my head. How do you actually operate one of these puppies down at the link layer? Are you even aware that it's multiples of 64K subchannels, or are you doing a different form of signaling inside this to run it as one composite service? Because these things get quite complicated.
Yeah, so we would run inverse multiplexers to push T1s together into T3s.
Which means you were actually having to resynchronize byte streams down these things. You had buffering either end of the line.
Right. And what you do is you just put bit one on line one, bit two on line two, bit three on line three, or whatever it is, and or blocks of data. And then, like you said, at the other end, the inverse multiplexer on the other end is doing that. An inverse multiplexer is like the backwards cable breakout. It's like taking 10 1 gig links, and you get a 10 gig on the other end. And by the way, an interesting aside here is that we think of 100 gig Ethernet as being 100 gig. It's really not. It's really 425 gig Ethernet bundled onto using QAM onto a single optic.
So we've kind of moved up the food chain to discussing available bandwidth in digital signaling terms as bit rates, as if they are one single stream of things. And all the time, it's layers of the onion, it's turtles all the way down. Right down at the bottom, it's still Manchester encoding of the bits. And there's still all kinds of bit error rate and adaptive signaling happening and reframing and retransmitting. There's a lot of work going on there. A lot.
Yeah. So I just thought it was interesting that going back to ISDN, that it did last so long and that it had such a massive influence on the industry at large.
Banking and telecommunications, I think, is the neglected component of how a lot of internet growth happened. I mean, we like to think it's about the consumer market and the surge in home use. But in order to be viable to ship units at scale, you need a guaranteed customer base. And the home market was a little bit less guaranteed. I mean, these were geeks in corners doing BBSs. These guys are going to build a $1 billion industry. Doesn't look a good bet, right? But if a single bank says, hi, I have 2,000 branches and I commit to buying 2,000 64K ISDN circuits for telephony and another for my banking computing system and another for my ATM network, and all I ask is that you connect me to two telephone exchanges, the vendor side is saying, wow, I just sold a router with at least 8 circuits on it at the head, and I just sold something bigger, a beefier unit back in the telco. I'm making serious sale here. I can justify rolling this stuff out because I've got book for a customer who is committed. So there actually was a thing here in Australia. My ISDN option came in two flavors. One was banking grade. I paid serious money to have a reliable service. And the other was semi-pro consumer grade. And the deal was I was the backup circuit for the bank. That thing I said 2B plus D, a line card with two circuits. If the bank lost service, mine was at liberty to be replugged. And if the bank needed a card reset, my line was dropped. Those kinds of things, right? Those economics drove a lot of the growth of ISDN. It was the big customers.
You talk about 8 circuits, 8 ISDN circuits. That's essentially 3 V60s, 360 port plugs, or I'm sorry, 6 or 8 of them. And that's essentially, how many did an AGS Plus handle, or an MGS? What was it, 32? That you could even do. And so whatever it was, you've taken up a quarter of the capacity of a single MGS with a couple of ATM machines.
But you've sold that machine.
That's right. I mean, you've sold that machine.
Yeah. So there's a very happy camper in the sales and marketing department if you get one of these. And it's got a certain nobody got fired for buying IBM quality. It came with the seal of approval. You knew how it worked. It wasn't fussy. Now, inside the frame, so inside the sealed room, we were leafing through catalogs. There's this company in Australia called Black Box. And it was basically a provider of magic boxes to convert A to B. So, right, V35. That's synchronous. That's designed to be used by people who have the ability to do synchronous, clock-synced data service between two points. You go read a Cisco manual for HDLC, the framing technology here, and it's very clear. This will run on synchronous or asynchronous lines. But you wind up sometimes having synchronous one end, asynchronous the other. What do? You get the black box catalog, you flick through it until you find someone, typically an Israeli specialist technology company, who will sell you a small black box that when it's plugged in, it converts a synchronous line to an async line. Or you get a piece of equipment shipped from head office. Oh my God, it's a T1 box. It can't do E-series. You get a black box that does the bit stripping to convert T1 to E1 in your room so that you can not have to ship it back home to Idaho and get shipped another unit. So there was this huge behind the scenes recipes to get over the humps. But at the front door, it looked like a wall plate that was a reliable digital service. And I think that was huge, really huge. I think that bootstrapped a lot of belief this thing is going to work.
Yeah. In fact, I think that's probably what drove a lot of the sales was before this time, everything was very, you know, magic. Like you had these people walk in, like when we were doing the system on the Air Force Base, where it was, it was inverse multiplexers. Everybody was like, this is totally magic. Like, this is crazy. And, you know, it kind of standardized things enough. And I think that standardization, interestingly enough, drove a lot of the terminology and the way we view telco networks today. The D channels, the B channels, the names of the channels, the points in the network. Like, you know, you were talking about, what is it, a network termination unit. NTU is still used in 5G.
Oh, yeah.
There's no CPE. Such thing as an NTE, okay? It's not what it does, but yet we still call it that. Why?
Yeah.
Because ISDN, right?
So that, to me, might be the part that keeps on going a long time after anyone thinks ISDN is the thing. I think that terminology and those key concepts around the nature of networks and their framing is going to persist. And it's kind of funny that people will be using terms in the future about all optical networks and all fiber delivery, or about complex radio G-series standards. And somewhere inside it, they're going to talk about a thing and it's going to be, yeah, because ISDN.
Yeah,
that's going to be its legacy in a lot of ways.
Yeah, because I remember reading the ISDN manuals, and there was like point one is called, I don't remember all the names, but like this is 1.A, 1.B, whatever. All those terminology, when I read 5G stuff, it's all the same. And it's nowhere near the same technology. It's not even making sense within the technical framework.
So another part of this that I think is interesting is the way ISDN is kind of the last mile of telco-specified standards and internet geeks in some ways agreeing what they were doing. And I think the people behind a lot of these standards in CCITT and ITU looked at what we were doing in IETF and thought, we'd like a piece of that pie. How about we move up the stack doing our own spec? And a lot of people in IETF space, because, I mean, jokes aside, there were a lot of vendors there, Russ, and they were people of good spirit trying to make things happen. We're kind of pushing down the other way, saying, wow, if everything's going IP and it's framing around these IP packets, why don't we start making chipsets that deal with this properly and drive them down the stack a bit? And it's kind of these weird competing pressures. ISDN is the last point where the two tribes would get in a room together and walk out with a common basis. After ISDN, there's competing technologies happening here.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, if you look at ITU and CLNS and all of that, right, which was basically telco driven. And, you know, here in the US, we were still doing IP.
IP over X25 existed, but people were very, very uncomfortable with some of its behavior because the way it was provided to them was just a complete mismatch for the expectation. So then you get ATM on the service and it's kind of, you've done what? A cell size of what? That doesn't have any meaning for us, right? But here's the thing, the chipsets for ATM those chipsets bootstrapped ADSL modems. All the framing, all the management of the underlying reliable signaling is being done by repurposed ATM chipsets driven down into the modem-sized units and the BMUX. So, no, we didn't all buy ubiquitous ATM networks globally. We didn't do that, but we kept a bit of their technology.
Yeah, and in fact, the entire ATM revolution, in some sense, helped drive along the revolution in chassis backplanes. Because there was the Cisco 8500, which was an ATM switch with IP line cards sitting on either side of the ATM fabric. And it kind of gave this idea of why am I having this passive backplane, which is what the AGS and the MGS had. And why don't I have an active backplane that can actually switch traffic? And doesn't that make things a lot better to have an active backplane, that interconnects the cards? So the Cat5 was basically the last passive backplane that I know of that was ever built. And everything after that went to an active backplane because of the experience with, because of the experiences with things like ATM backplanes in chassis boxes that were primarily designed for IP. So this interplay has a lot of things that come out of it in many different ways. And Tom's sitting here on the side going, I don't even know what a Cisco 8500 is. I've never even heard of this box.
Oh, come on. I've heard of it.
I like the idea that there are still pieces of equipment where the cardboard has an IKEA-style picture of two people lifting the box and a big red cross through one guy going, oh! Because, and, yeah. I like to believe we still need big grunty machines. And every now and then I kind of check myself thinking and I think, dude, first of all, your days of being in machine rooms are long gone. You'd be a liability in there, so it's not going to be you. And second of all, what do you need a big box for? What was actually going on there?
Yeah, if you look at the evolution, right, we went to active backplanes, which then became Ethernet, right?
Inside the
chassis, which then became clofabrics inside the chassis using the same switching devices as what's being used on the line cards, which then begs the question, or then makes you ask the question, begs the question. That's illogical. I'm not using it. But anyway, which then leads to the question of, wait, if this is just a clofabric, why don't I just build a clofabric and put it in a single rack and not have the chassis? You know, it's,
yeah,
there's like a line of thinking there that's pretty interesting.
So I noticed the last time I did a deploy that it was about the budget, the energy budget to drive the ZFP. It was a 20-kilometer fiber run in Beijing between two exchange points. And the primary question was, is there enough power coming to the ZFP to drive this line? And it wasn't actually yet rated. And I thought, we're no longer talking about internet and we're no longer talking about digital communications. We're talking about power budgets and power engineering and the delivery of reliable power service and the power draw to light up lasers to run this communication. That was the limiting factor. And maybe these big boxes, this big iron, is about the transformers and the switching technology, power switching technology to drive lines. So, okay, imagine you're driving copper. As you said, copper, it's resistance. Copper ages out. It's a problem. So let's say we switch to doing this all optical. Do we actually reduce the burden? I mean, do we need exchanges that have huge lead acid batteries everywhere? Do we need that investment in infrastructure if we go all optical? I'm not sure we do.
Or maybe we do. I don't know. Optical still consumes a lot of power.
It does. But is that because of the optical-electrical-optical reframing? If we were pure optical with optical switching, which is kind of like fusion. There's a guy I know from the Research and Education Network who used to tell me every year without fail he was going to be getting an all-optical switch. And it never showed, right? We don't have all-optical. It's a chimera.
Yeah, it is. It is. All right. So That's really cool. Thanks, George, for coming on and talking about this. It was an interesting article on ISDN. I'll put a pointer to it in the show notes when we publish this. And, you know, it just brought back a lot of memories for me because, as you can tell, I've been doing this for a long time, maybe too long. Maybe it's time for me to quit and start drawing dinosaurs or something for a living. I don't know. But
Keep banging the rocks together, Russ.
You never can tell when this all ends. So, Tom, where can people get in touch with you if they want to or follow your work?
I'm on LinkedIn and also Twitter. Just search for Tom Ammon and you'll find me.
And there is a black hole in the internet where his blog should be. We won't talk about that. It's like other blogs get sucked into the black hole and disappear. I don't know what goes on in Tom's blog, but anyway. And George, where can people get in touch with you or follow you? I know you sometimes write on Circle ID and AP Nick.
A little bit. I'm on the blog at blog.apnic.net, and you can always find me online in some list somewhere, some dark corner. I'll be there.
Okay.
Watching.
All right. And I know George also participates in the IETF and comes to NOGs and stuff. So he's around on those lists as well.
I really enjoyed this, Russ. That was very, very good fun for me. A lot of memories surfacing inside this shiny head of mine.
He's gonna go back to his kitchen now and throw up. He's really like, I can't believe I didn't remember ISDN. That's terrible.
Well, it's great. It's great for me because it's been a while since I've been on an archaeological dig. So thanks, guys.
Wow.
Okay. We should do this again sometime.
We should. All right. And I'm Russ White. You can always find me here at The Hedge and on Rule11.tech. And thanks for dropping by for this episode of The Hedge.
Subscribe to The Hedge on your favorite podcast service or follow along at Rule11.tech.